Forget soft power. It's all about hard bargains. Donald Trump making good on his campaign promise of tariffs and starting with his closest neighbors, Canada and Mexico. We'll ask if it's all a big made-for-reality TV drama that ends at the negotiating table. After all, Trump's already hit pause for Mexico. How much has the world's most powerful nation decided to throw its weight around? We'll gauge reactions. Trump turning heads at his inauguration when he referenced William McKinley, the tariff-loving turn of the 20th century predecessor to Theodore Roosevelt, who tested the powers of the presidency and went to war with Spain to assert dominance over the Americas and South Pacific. On that score, Trump's threats to annex Panama yielding results, it seems, with the Central American nation telling his Secretary of State that it's ready to allow Panama's participation to expire in China's Belt and Road Infrastructure Initiative. Enough to quell talk of land grabs today in the France 24 debate. We're talking about Trump's tariff threats. With us, Philip Golub, professor of political science at the American University of Paris. You are the author of Power, Profit, and Prestige, A History of American Imperial Expansion.
It talks a lot, actually. The book has a whole chapter on the late 19th century imperialist urge. Yeah.
Okay, how we went from talking about Andrew Jackson during Trump's first presidency to talking about William McKinley during his second.
And Theodore Roosevelt.
We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Pascal Drouot is president of, do I pronounce this right, LATFRAN?
Yes.
LATFRAN. The Latin America France Caribbean Exchange Group. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
From Washington, Pedro da Costa, head of policy for the Americas at Market News International. Good to see you.
Thanks so much for having me.
By the way, you can listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. They have an expression in North America, citizens who are north of the U.S. border with the reputation of being Canada nice. Well, Dateline Toronto, and on Sunday night before an NBA basketball game. Anthem booed before the NBA match between the Raptors and the Los Angeles Clippers. Let's cross to Toronto. Emily Ragabeer, journalist, joins us there. Emily, that's not very Canada nice.
It's not. And as Donald Trump would love, I guess, the world to think that Canada is just all friendly, as we do have this reputation around the world. However, Canada is not foolish, and nor are they weak. And Donald Trump is really putting forth, as our panel, I'm very interested to get into this discussion, is really putting forth a tremendous bullying tactic here. And right now the pressure is squarely on the prime minister of this country. We have a conversation coming up between Trudeau and President Trump, in the coming hours. And the idea is, if there is grace for Mexico, at least to pause these crippling tariffs for a month for Mexico, hopefully that should be extended here in Canada. But, you know, Canada can't contend with this. They can't allow it. This is a sovereign country. And effectively, Donald Trump is threatening that sovereignty by these bullish threats economically and today territorially, bringing up again, making Canada the 51st state of America.
Yeah, Trump saying he had a good conversation with Justin Trudeau earlier. The two are going to speak again, as you say. There has been, as you say, pushback where you are, and it's across the political divide. Ontario's Conservative Premier Doug Ford tweeting. Let's take a look at what he had to say. He said starting today and until U.S. tariffs are removed, Ontario is banning American companies from provincial contracts. We're going one step further. We'll be ripping up the province's contract with Starlink. Ontario won't do business with people hell-bent on destroying our economy. Of course, Emily, Starlink owned by Elon Musk, who's Trump's big advisor these days.
Absolutely. Elon Musk is, as we all know, Trump's pretty much right hand in politics and in economics, whether he has that experienced or not. Everyone knows he doesn't, but nonetheless, he has that advantage and that insight into pretty confidential information that really he shouldn't have, but Donald Trump has given them that liberty. But of course, Doug Ford, we are currently, as you mentioned, in a race in this province of Ontario, an election race. And so he has been the premier of Ontario, and he is the conservative candidate. But he did mention today that he is not interested in any American contracts. And of course, the coveted Starlink contract, which would afford people in rural Ontario, rural Canada, connectivity, satellite connectivity, stronger internet, that sort of thing. He's not interested in it. Liquor has been cleared off or will be cleared off of Ontario shelves and across provinces in this country. The liquor board alone is the Ontario's liquor board, the LCBO, is the biggest liquor board and has billions of dollars worth that will be taken away from Americans per Donald Trump's threats.
Pedro Acosta, is this just a bit of theater and then at the end of the day, Donald Trump and Justin Trudeau will patch it up?
They might patch it up today, but I don't think it's theater. I think the president's desire to use tariffs as, you know, as a way to get countries to do what he thinks they need to do is, I think, embedded into his style of presidency. And I think the markets have underestimated so far his willingness to kind of go there. One of the major surprises for me is, given the rhetoric that's been ramped up on both sides of the aisle against China, that the president would choose to go against his allies before he takes on China. Of course, there were Chinese tariffs announced as well, but he seems so far to have soft-pedaled on China while going pretty hard on the allies.
Why?
That's a strategy that I have not yet figured out the point of. It might be that, you know, the administration has a sense of kind of regional strengthening its power regionally before going after its major adversary. That might be one interpretation. Another way to look at it is that they're reserving their kind of anti-China forces in the Panama Canal related discussions, and that they think that that's a major thing that they could win over in against China. But it's hard to say. And I think the issue for the administration is that it's, I think it diminishes the trust, you know, in our partners around the world, and it makes it difficult for future negotiations. And also for U.S., I think you mentioned, you know, who needs soft power. Well, I think soft power can be underestimated, the importance of soft power. And I think that if we, you know, play hardball too often, we might risk losing to places like China and Russia in terms of their soft power influences in parts of the world.
All right. I want to get back to this issue of soft power. But first, Philip, do you care to have a crack as to why Donald Trump is going harder at a 25% tariff threats for Canada and Mexico, but just 10% for China?
Well, I mean, he's doing it incrementally in the case of China, okay? His policy towards China is probably dictated by longer-term considerations. He, like the Biden administration, have been building up pressure on China for quite some time.
Is it because Elon Musk sells cars in China?
I think Elon Musk is part of that equation. I don't think he's the only factor in that equation. I know that there's a broad consensus in the U.S. security and national elite establishments, including in the circles around Donald Trump, that China represents the most fundamental long-term challenge to the United States. And so whatever happens now is epiphenomenal in a certain kind of way. Maybe he thinks he can arrive at some kind of temporary deal with Xi Jinping. But in the middle term, the real test of strength is going to be coming, going down the road, because there is no question that the U.S. wants to contain China. We've heard this in a number of different locations, and the Chinese know this, and the Chinese are trying to get around this. I just want to say one other thing on this. Donald Trump is not making America great again. He's making China great again by deconstructing MACA, make China MCA, make China great again. By deconstructing to some extent, at least, the alliance systems that the United States built up since the late 1940s, what he's doing is giving China an opportunity to assert a more benevolent kind of image worldwide. Not soft power. Soft power is a soft concept. I don't think it's terribly meaningless.
All right, let's take a look then. We talked about Canada. Let's take a look at Mexico. The president there claiming that she's already earned a one-month reprieve on 25% tariffs. Claudia Sheinbaum announcing the deployment of 10,000 troops to the border and requesting help from Donald Trump in the conversation they had and stopping the inflow of guns.
The Mexican president says she's waiting for Trump's reply to her proposal for dialogue.
I proposed to President Trump that we establish a working group with our best teams, both from security and public health. It is not through the imposition of tariffs that problems are solved, but through talking and dialogue.
Right, that was Sheinbaum on Sunday. Let's listen to Claudia Sheinbaum just a short while ago.
He made several proposals, and we finally agreed to send more soldiers to the northern border to protect it and to limit drug trafficking, particularly fentanyl. I told him that we wanted him to hit pause on increasing customs duties. I told him this from the outset, and we reached an agreement on the issue.
Pedro Costa, I just want to go back to what you said at the outset, that it's not just political theater. But here, isn't this a masterclass? Claudia Sheinbaum making a big announcement, 10,000 troops to placate the U.S. president. Isn't that what he wants?
Absolutely. I think it is in the short term. What I mean that it's not just political theater is that this reversal does not remove the threat of tariffs altogether. In fact, this sort of Damocles continues to hang over, the countries and the markets over a prolonged period. And in that sense, as the reintroduction of that tool as a consistent tool of economic policy introduces all kinds of uncertainties and is really a novelty for U.S. economic policy in our lifetimes. And so I think we need to contend with that. And even though there might be sort of small apparent, agreements, I think it poses questions about how the U.S. is going to renegotiate the formerly known as NAFTA USMCA agreement, for instance, when it comes up for renegotiation. It raises questions of trust between trading partners that will not go away quickly. And it has all kinds of macroeconomic implications, especially because, again, with the case of China, these might be step increases that we're looking at. And there, may very well be retaliation down the line. So we might get some early reprieve. The other thing I'd point out is the president is trying to thread the needle between doing things that aren't necessarily in concert. He wants to raise tariffs while at the same time lowering prices for consumers and keeping the stock market buoyant. And that's a difficult thing to accomplish, which might explain some of the erraticness of the behavior that we see.
Pascal Drouot, we remember back in 2017 when Trump was first elected. It didn't go very well with Mexico at the beginning then either. But it did end, as Pedro was saying, with this renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Again, have times changed? Is it different this time?
I think so. And I think that the Trump administration understood that Latin America and the first border, Mexico, was abandoned during many years. Focusing, Marco Rubio is now traveling in Central America.
We'll talk more about that.
On Latin America, yes. He's showing that it is not only time of the backyard. It is time to restore special links with Latin America. Latin America being abandoned during many years,
Threat of tariffs this time, is it different from the threat of tariffs last time?
Well, in Latin America, the real threat is the underdevelopment, is the injustice, is the presence of some countries as Nicaragua, Venezuela, who are with the authoritarianism regime under umbrella, the umbrella of Russia, of China, and obviously due some question of bad governance, of underdevelopment. You have the point of the...
But in places like Mexico, is Donald Trump winning fans with what he's doing?
Why Mexico didn't took this measure that Claudia Sheinbaum just announced? Why they didn't do that, send 10,000 soldiers, military, to the border before? So is she just showed that Donald Trump is right.
Philip Gallup?
Well, sending those troops is not going to change very much in terms of the flows of fentanyl to the United States. It might have some marginal impact on immigration flows, but it's not going to stop the very covert networks of drug trafficking. No, I think what we're seeing here are demonstrations. You know, you have it's coercive public diplomacy and coercive economic diplomacy that the threat, what our one of the previous speakers said, the threat of an action actually produces some results, but doesn't lift the possibility of that action being taken in the future. So there's always a Damocles sword hanging over the heads of the Latin American countries. The asymmetry of power between the Latin Americans and the United States has always been very great. Since the late 19th century. And that asymmetry of power explains much of that relationship and the ability of Trump to actually use coercive economic diplomacy to achieve some of his ends. Mexico has a single market dependency on the United States, which forces Mexico into a position where it's in very difficult position constantly in its ability to maneuver diplomatically. Mexico will have to gradually pull out of that single market dependency, orient towards Europe as much as possible, and possibly towards China, actually, to actually find alternatives to that. But for the moment, they're under the constant possibility of a threat of being cut off from the American market, which is much more severe for Mexico than it is for the United States. You're seeing similar coercive economic diplomacy being applied elsewhere. Trump thinks that you not only, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick. You know?
That was what U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt.
That's Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt. Speak softly and carry a big stick. In his case, it's speak hard and carry a very big stick.
Yes, but Donald Trump chose people who knows very well Latin America. Mauricio Claver Caron, the special envoy to Marco Rubio's. Michael Watts, Marco Rubio's. Pamela Bondi. They are all linked by Florida and having a special link with Latin America. So the problem is
Or at least parts of Latin America.
But of course, but specifically talking about Latin America, the problem is not Mexico. The problem is a co-responsibility in the same continent between the backyard and the USA. The point is, of course, the migrants are showing the problem of governance. And I think that Trump today and the administration are sending a strong message to Latin America saying that's your responsibility. Why people is moving, why people is walking to our border and to our market, because they don't feel any future in your countries, guys. So if you want change, let's change the regime of Maduro. Let's change Ortega. Let's do what you want to do, etc.
So Pedro da Costa, is Donald Trump winning hearts and minds in Mexico?
I mean, I don't think he's winning hearts and minds in Mexico today, but I think and I don't think that's his strategy, though. That's his. He's trying to, you know, win. He's trying to deliver on the promises of his campaign. And so the question is, are the tools that he's using so far, are they going to achieve even the goals that he wants to achieve, which is restricting immigration at the border, restricting, you know, drug trafficking at the border? Is that going to be effective? And the problem is very large. It requires, you know, billions of dollars in spending and congressional approval. So these are just initial measures, but I think it's going to be hard to show hard, concrete victories in what were very big campaign promises that he made on this issue.
Emily Ragubir, the White House National Economic Council Director, Kevin Hassett, telling CNBC that so far in these negotiations, Mexico appeared to be very, very serious about doing what Donald Trump says. But the Canadians, quote, appear to have misunderstood the plain language of the executive order. What are Canadians supposedly misunderstanding here?
You know, it's quite funny. I used to work with somebody who used to always ask the question, but what does that mean? And that is exactly what the news anchor that you were citing in that interview asked Trump's advisor on this, because you read between the lines, Donald Trump initiated this issue regarding border security, at least here in Canada and, of course, in the U.S., the southern border. To that, the Canadian government put forth $1.3 billion of investment at the Canada-U.S. border. That includes everything from Black Hawk helicopters, intelligence, manpower, tech, new technologies, you name it. That investment has been made. Like, you know, in comparison, now Mexico has put 10,000 troops at the border. But still, that is an enormous effort on the initiative to, I guess you could say, appease Donald Trump that the Canadians have done. But that certainly doesn't seem to be what now Donald Trump is interested in. And if you compare upwards of, I think there was 21,000 pounds of fentanyl was copped at the Mexican-U.S. border, comparison to 43 pounds here in the northern border between Canada and the U.S. So what Donald Trump is really speaking of, what his advisor is telling American media that Canada doesn't understand, that this has to do with security. It doesn't have to do with taxes. We say tariffs. This is taxes. We have to be clear that this is a tax on the American people, taxing on Canadian as well. But this will in no way bring down the cost of living, exactly what Donald Trump ran his campaign on for the American people. This will skyrocket it, especially given that oil and gas energy exports is the biggest export to the United States that the United States depend on. If we look to Quebec, Quebec's aluminum is a 75 to 90% exported to the United States that their key industries depend on. So Donald Trump is really giving the impression to his people in America that this is an overnight fix. Do they have the infrastructure to put in place in the next month? I don't think so. The crude oil that Alberta sends to America has their refineries, for example, in Texas. It's a specific crude oil that Alberta sends down to them. He's not speaking in details to the Americans on this. He's saying these broad stroke statements that really have nothing to do with the actual fact across the board.
Yeah, but it's, again, there's if you're looking at announcements, Donald Trump able to at least claim wins with those 10,000 troops being sent to the U.S.-Mexico border. We had the U.S. Secretary of State, who's now landed in El Salvador after going to Panama, claiming victory there. In fact, Donald Trump a few minutes ago echoing what Marco Rubio said, that Panama had agreed on some things after he repeatedly threatened to take over the canal again. China's Belt and Road Infrastructure Initiative, Panama said it would let it expire.
One important thing that I decided, and I told him this, is that the 2017 memorandum concerning the Silk Road Agreement will not be renewed.
So, Emily Ragubir, Donald Trump's threats having an impact?
It is. It's created a huge sense of anxiety across the territories, the provinces here. Remember, we have a huge country. We are the second biggest geographical country here. We share the longest undefended, demilitarized border, which we are quite proud of with America. And Donald Trump is threatening all of that seemingly overnight. Of course, Justin Trudeau, the prime minister of this country, he has had to take a hard stance on this. And over the weekend, Donald Trump said, he threatened that if Canada does take these retaliatory measures, that Trump could escalate that. What does that even mean? Nobody knows. I don't know if anybody could really get into the president of the United States' head, but we have to deal with what we know. And what we know is these tariffs are coming. And so what's that going to mean? Everything, a comprehensive list thus far, and this is only list one of over 1,200 items on this list that the government released to Canadians, everything from meat, vegetables, fruit, home appliances, cosmetics, you name it. Officials here are saying to make it easier for Canadians at the grocery store, at shops, for example, to put a Canadian flag to make it easier for them to realize or understand which products are Canadian, and to particularly buy Canadian or buy products from other countries, but do not buy anything that has to do currently with Americans, and also encouraging Canadians to halt travel, if you will. They didn't say that in those exact terms, but that is the encouragement, to halt travel to America for the time being until Canada can somehow get this under control.
Right.
And the intent is to stop these tariffs before they come through tomorrow.
Emily Ragubir, I know you're monitoring it for this, and there'll be that second phone call of the day between Justin Trudeau and Donald Trump coming up. Thanks so much for joining us here in the France 24 debate. And again, in the last minutes, Marco Rubio, the U.S. Secretary of State, saying he's optimistic on the capacity of Panama to dissipate worries over the canal. So the U.S. Perhaps easing off that threat to try and grab by force the Panama Canal. It's a good week if you like power plays at the bargaining table. Not so great if you're one of the 600 staff locked out Monday morning from the U.S. Agency for International Development's computer system, or barred from entering their headquarters in Washington when we tried to log on to its website. The agency, the world's largest purveyor of humanitarian aid, was down. That's the statement in French we had on this end. This follows Elon Musk announcing its shutdown. The billionaire tech giant who's advising Trump on streamlining government, calling USAID a criminal organization, a sentiment that was echoed by the president.
USAID, run by radical lunatics, and we're getting them out, and then we'll make a decision.
Now, you heard earlier in the conversation, Philip Golub, Pedro da Costa saying Donald Trump doesn't care what the rest of the world thinks. He's making his decisions with a squarely domestic calculus. Still, what's the impact of this?
Well, I think Pedro da Costa is absolutely right. He doesn't care about international reactions to that. He doesn't care about the image that he gives of the United States at the international level. He's, if you look at him in historical tradition, if you can find some type of comparative point in the historical tradition, he's a continentalist, all right? He's a sovereignist, a continentalist, who thinks in terms of the Western Hemisphere as being the natural, both geographically natural and politically and hegemonically natural area of the United States, that the United States should naturally dominate Canada. Even if it doesn't grab its territory, it has to dominate Canada. It has to dominate Central America, the Panama Isthmus, and indeed all of South America. You look at all of the ultra-nationalists who surrounded McKinley, Theodore Roosevelt, and afterwards, their worldview was not Atlantic. Their worldview was continental, Western Hemispheric, and the Pacific. Their experience had been the experience of Western expansion, Western territorial expansion, at the expense, of course, of the Amerindian populations and others. So he's an expansionist. He's a continentalist expansionist, and he sees himself in that tradition. That's one thing. If you ask whether this fits 21st century realities, that's another question, you see, whether this makes any sense in a globalized world to crack the transnational linkages of the globalized world, whether it makes sense to make the alliances brittle, to weaken your northern neighbors. It doesn't make sense, but it makes sense from the standpoint of his own understanding of the world.
So shutting the doors to the USAID, threatening tariffs?
No. Well, I think that
Pascal
Donald Trump,
Drew, your thoughts on this?
No, I think that Trump care very much his image and is making the policy on which one he has been elected.
He cares about his image domestically.
But we obviously for us, USAID means something, but it's not closing USAID. It's closing some programs of USAID. Why? Because
it's closing its headquarters
yes,
and saying that they now
have
to report to the State Department.
Yes, but he defined objectives when he came 2 weeks ago at the White House. He said, my enemy is the wokeism. So he's fighting against all the programs, all the posture, all countries who would be for him linked with this vision of the world, with the wokeism.
Well, like so, we're pulling out of the World Health Organization.
I don't say I agree or disagree.
The World Health Organization is fighting wokeism?
Some programs, perhaps. No. That they are the program focused and closed since yesterday. I don't say I agree. I disagree. I try to understand. And so as soon he came inside the White House, 2 weeks ago, everyone in the world, because he talked about Canada, because he talked about Panama the first day, etc., understood what Donald Trump wants for his next 4 years. He wants to rupture. He wants to be the first one. He wants the USA first in the world. Everyone understood, and that's what is making we are agree or not working because or not agree because he has been elected on that and is making the program on which one is
so
elected.
So, Pedro da Costa, I'm interested to know what are the reactions in Washington where you are, because USAID being shut on a decision that seems to almost be jointly announced, even though they weren't at the same place at the same time, by Donald Trump and by a billionaire Elon Musk, who has this role of advisor, who's not officially in the cabinet. Do Americans care?
I think the reaction in Washington and do Americans care is different. I think Washington was somewhat prepared for sort of this regimented destruction of the what they call the administrative state or the deep state. So they were promising to go after agencies. I don't think people knew that USAID would be kind of the sample agency. And I think people there are certainly surprised that it's happening. But if you think about it, it does make sense in a sort of America first agenda that you would cut off foreign aid, right? It's something that you wouldn't see as particularly necessary if you're a very continentally focused president. And so I think there's consternation in Washington in the sense that there's just concern and deep uncertainty about what agency might be next and where there might be purges. Of course, this is happening in the context of like headlines that are almost difficult to keep up with, right? There's been a proposal to get rid of the FDIC. There's been a firing of the CFPB director, who's now, and apparently the CFPB is being subsumed into Treasury. So there's almost, you know, too much to keep up with, which I think is part of the policy. Part of the policy is to move so fast that it's difficult for A, the media to keep up with it, and B, for any kind of democratic opposition to take hold.
Yeah, those live images we're showing are of Donald Trump signing executive orders. It is difficult, Pedro, to keep up with it all.
And in that sense, I think it's effective in terms of this domestic push to dismantle parts of the federal government that Donald Trump and the party deem to be inefficient or not useful. The other part of this is that they're using, you know, these cuts in domestic federal agencies as part of this kind of DOGE process that's supposed to contribute significantly to deficit reduction.
Yeah, DOGE being that agency set up by Elon Musk, which also has the name of his cryptocurrency.
Exactly. The Department of Government Efficiency, also named after the cryptocurrency that he has tended to bolster. And so I think the idea that they will find enough savings in these cuts to put a significant dent in the deficit, I think most economists do not believe that they can go after the deficit just with these measures.
All right. So it's interesting because here you have this sort of mix of a private citizen who's weighing in on public policy. We've talked about it before, and we'll talk about it again on this show. Silicon Valley falling in line behind the Trump doctrine with Google Maps, for instance, to display it as the Gulf of America for U.S. users once it's officially decreed. Elsewhere, it'll still be the Gulf of Mexico. That's the follow-up to an Inauguration Day promise by Donald Trump that also included restoring the former name of North America's highest peak, Mount Denali, returning it to Mount McKinley. This after that turn of the 20th century U.S. president.
President McKinley made our country very rich through tariffs and through talent. He was a natural businessman and gave Teddy Roosevelt the money for many of the great things he did, including the Panama Canal, which has foolishly been given to the country of Panama after the United States.
Philip Golub, historians expect a U.S. president at inauguration to reference George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, perhaps Franklin Roosevelt. Instead, he referenced William McKinley and his successor, Teddy Roosevelt. William McKinley, why William McKinley?
Well, it's interesting that his historical references obviously tell you something about where he comes from, okay, who he identifies with.
Most Americans have forgotten who William McKinley is.
Well, now they haven't forgotten him anymore, and the rest of the world either. It reminded people elsewhere in the world that the United States has a history that's not entirely understandable through the 1945 prism of American hegemony and Pax Americana. McKinley and Roosevelt were presidents at a time of American ascent, okay? The United States became the world's leading industrial power, the world's leading manufacturing power by the mid-1880s, and were effectively the dominant world industrial power by 1900. In 1914, the United States accounted for 32% of world manufacturing output, okay? Manufacturing output. And by 1929, just before the crash, 39% of world manufacturing output. So they presided over this moment of industrial ascent to the United States, which then led to the Gilded Age, of course, as we know. Mm. And they presided over a moment of international expansionism, because continental expansionism had reached its limit. The transcontinental railroad.
Yeah, they fought a war with Spain.
Yeah. The transcontinental railroad had been finished in the 60s. Alaska was purchased through coercive economic diplomacy vis-a-vis of Russia in 1867. The U.S. had basically taken on its current form, and what happened in 1898, the war with Spain in 1898. Was that the United States essentially manufactured, McKinley essentially, his administration manufactured what they called the Splendid Little War. That's what it was called by Secretary John Hay, the Splendid Little War with Spain, that Spain lost. Spain was a decaying empire, which allowed the United States to expand into the Caribbean, East Asia, the Philippines, that the United States colonized after having liberated it for a couple of days, then colonized it quite brutally so, and of course the Pacific, Hawaii and Guam and other islands in the Pacific. So it gave the United States for the first time what looked like a transoceanic formal empire, whereas the empire previously had been a continental empire. So it was a high point of American. It was the outcome of a high point of continental expansionism. Okay, and that continental expansionism was what gave the energies to McKinley and then Roosevelt to embark upon imperialist venture. Theodore Roosevelt was an ardent imperialist. If you read the specialized work on his foreign policy, he was an ardent imperialist. The entire crowd around McKinley.
So is Donald Trump an ardent imperialist?
Well, I don't know if he's. I don't know if he knows it quite in the same way as the advisors of McKinley did. But if you look at Admiral Mahan, if you look at Henry Cabot Lodge, who brought down the League of Nations, these were ardent imperialists.
So this harks back to a time, Pascal Drouot, where on this continent. There was a scramble for Africa. It was an expansionist time. What did you think when you heard Donald Trump referencing William McKinley in his inauguration speech?
I think that's absolutely normal.
Normal?
Normal. William McKinley was a protectionist specialist. He was representative of Ohio, lawyer, specialist on the protectionist customs duties. His presidency has been based on protectionism, thinking that it will bring prosperity for the U.S. And, for sure, on the international development of the U.S.
But do the recipes of 1897 work in 2025?
No, but that's symbolic. Donald Trump today, as a politician, wants to represent the rupture with the former administration. So he needs some reference. keenly, definitely represent this vision of protectionism for prosperity. At that time, the U.S. Could win because transferring territories, because the war with Spain, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, Hawaii, Philippines. So it was an expansion in times of empires. It was time of empires, definitely.
And is today a time of empires, Pedro da Costa? We're still at the advent, perhaps, of the information age, and you have these titans of Silicon Valley were front and center at the inauguration. Does Donald Trump know perhaps what many don't? Is this a time when the United States can impose its will?
That's the thing. I think that's what the optimists on his side are hoping, is that, you know, the U.S. is the only game in town as far as force. China is actually weakened, not only economically, but arguably militarily and politically as well. And so maybe now is the time where we need to worry less about our allies. And that's the kind of a cynical view. Maybe that's now is the time that we can swing our rate around and be more expansionist. And I think that is Donald Trump's kind of professed tendency. And we should take him at his word in the same way that we should take his idea that tariffs are the most beautiful word in the dictionary at its word, because I think these are things that he believes deeply and not just things that he's throwing around. Again, the challenge is that he has a limited political window in which to deliver that increased prosperity that's going to come from that protectionism. So I guess there are a few scenarios. He could skate by with a lot of bluster on protectionism and not a lot of action, which on the back of an already strong economy might leave us in a decent enough place that people are feeling good about growth. But if he does decide to ramp up the tariffs, then the economic consequences could potentially be deep.
Because Pedro, there was a headline in the Wall Street Journal this Monday, billionaires in the U.S. a little bit worried or thrown off because they thought it was going to be tax cuts before tariffs.
That's right, which is kind of a weird expectation. I mean, I think the American investment community has been far too sanguine about the Trump tariff ideas, because tariffs are something the president can implement unilaterally, and taxes are something that require congressional approval. And of course, the deadline for the expiry of the tax cuts is later down the line. So it was, I think, you know, the smart money was always on the idea of tariffs going first, but Wall Street had been kind of expecting that he would really kind of just use them as a negotiating tactic and not enforce them. So far, what we've seen with Mexico, maybe that'll be the case. But I think the very fact that he imposed them out of the gate leaves the threat, again, as we discussed earlier, hanging over people's heads in a way that will be uncomfortable for investors. And honestly, will already be inhibiting of investments. And even if the tariffs don't go into effect, I think there will be a certain crimping of investment just based on the uncertainty around them.
All right, there's a prediction. We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. Pedro da Costa, many thanks for joining us from Washington. I want to thank Pascal Trouot. Philip Golub, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.